Good morning, Your Honor. My name's Alan Rosenfeld, bar number 30317. Please the court. Before I begin, I do want to correct, there was a citation that opposing counsel noted in her answer. It was a typographical error. In my reply brief, I cited to a section of the transcript as if it were the June 29th, 2009 transcript, and it should have been July 6th. Pages are correct, it's just a clerical error in terms of the date. There are three critical issues that I would like to try to address if time allows me. Each of which I think are both important areas of law, but also each by themselves would warrant reversal of the case. Case law obviously relies, in its affirmative defense, relies primarily on Mossman, which established that it's necessary to put a time frame on when a parent who takes a child into hiding in violation of custody order, when she had her reasonable belief. Or her belief. It's up to the jury to decide whether she really had the belief, whether her belief was objectively reasonable under the circumstances. But the time frame applies to when she had her belief. Obviously, and this is what Mossman is clear about, if a parent has a fear for her child 2 years prior and then doesn't act, and in the intervening 2 years, 3 years, there's nothing that increases her, nothing that changes, nothing that increases her fear. A trial court is appropriate in saying, no, it's what was your belief at the time that she left. On the other hand, someone's belief at the time that she acts to go into hiding can very reasonably be based on incidents that occurred substantially in the past as cumulative acts. Obviously, a child makes a disclosure, which is how most of these cases begin. A child says to a parent, "Daddy touched me. Daddy touched me and hurt." And if the parent who's accused, the parent who the child says hurt her, touched her, has the chief judge of the court, has never had a parking ticket, it would be unreasonable for a mother to act on that belief. If, on the other hand, she could act on it and ask more questions and report it, but not to objectively believe at that point that the child has been sexually abused, would be unreasonable. If, on the other hand, the mother is aware that her ex-husband had been convicted 10 years earlier of sexual abuse of a child, or had been convicted 10 years earlier for possession and distribution of child pornography, those facts, which are known to her at the time the child makes disclosure, even though they're 10 years old, those facts are obviously relevant to make her beliefs objectively reasonable at that time.
But rather than talk about hypotheticals, why don't you elucidate for us, what is the evidence that you feel the court improperly excluded in this case? Because counsel for the state says it's hard to determine whether the evidence is even, whether this objection has even been preserved because of lack of citation to evidence in the record. So why don't you elucidate exactly what is it that you claim the court kept out of evidence in this case that should have been admitted to support her affirmative defense?
Court kept out, number one, the defendant's own experiences of having been beaten, threatened with a gun, sexually assaulted by the ex-husband. In addition, judge kept out a prior wife, the earlier wife, similar allegations, and her similar allegations, the prior wife. Again, if the mother didn't know it, it would be irrelevant. But the trial court wouldn't let the mother testify that one of the reasons she believed in the child's concerns and was frightened of his ex-husband was because the earlier wife had come to her and said, "He also abused my children. I've got adult children, and he had beaten them. He'd thrown them against the wall and caused serious injury to them. He was violent." So that's pretty much
two things.
Sure.
The wife's, you've identified for us two things. The alleged abuse against the defendant and the alleged abuse against the children of the prior marriage. Would that be a fair
capture? That's primarily where it all fit into those two areas.
Now, you started out by, I think, alluding to time frames in the Mossman case. Is it your position that the testimony that was excluded about the husband's treatment of the defendant was excluded because of time frame?
Yes, both because it was time frame, primarily because it was time frame, but also excluded because it wasn't specifically sexual abuse of the child. This is the second issue that I did want to get into, is that if the mother herself has been so severely beaten and raped and traumatized that she has, kind of, she's diagnosed with extreme post-traumatic stress disorder because of the wrongful behavior of the ex-husband, knowing that the ex-husband did those things to her, again, makes it objectively reasonable for her to believe her child when her child starts saying, "Daddy hurt me, Daddy scared me, Daddy threatened me," because they weren't the same type of instance, because she's an adult woman, but they were the same kind of dangerous, threatening behaviors. And that gets into the second issue, which is total exclusion of her post-traumatic stress disorder, which is also kind of that, because, and that's where it's all very circular, but again, the trial judge ruled, we have no evidence about her diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, even though it was critical to explain why she froze in front of the jury. The transcript is full of almost every prosecution witness who ran into her said she acted strange. She was unreasonably fearful. She just seemed odd.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. You mentioned that repeatedly in your brief, and I went and looked at the transcript. And as I understand the testimony, when they're saying she acted strange, for example, it was the people that drove her from Fort Collins to Missouri back in 2008 who said it was her strange behavior that caused them to be suspicious of the circumstances that she was reporting to them. Not that she was acting strange at the time of the trial, not that she was acting strange generally, but that the strange circumstances led them to call the police.
She was strange at all sorts of times at the trial, and unfortunately, I don't have the videotape, but she absolutely froze at the trial. It was a disability at trial that I wanted to explain to the jury, why does this woman act so strange? And the reason why the post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis couldn't be admitted, according to the judge, is because it was based on the bad acts by the father and would be prejudicial against the father. But that's, you know, kind of word circularly unreasonable. If someone else had caused her to suffer post-traumatic stress disorder, if she'd been raped by a stranger, beaten by a stranger, or involved in a terrorist attack, well, then the jury could know that's why she's acting strange and has PTSD. But because she was diagnosed as suffering PTSD specifically because of the abuse inflicted by the father, the judge wouldn't let us present it because it would be prejudicial.
Isn't that the point of the rules of evidence 407 that says you can bar evidence that's relevant if it's overly prejudicial?
Well, number one, it's even more critical. Yes, that is the purpose of the rule, but on the other hand, the reason why it's prejudicial is the same reason why it makes her belief all the more reasonable. If she indeed was so severely abused by her ex-husband that she's got this diagnosed condition, and again, if she was diagnosed by Dr. Lenore Walker, who's almost the family, you know, kind of the mother of the battered woman syndrome, the one who's written the books. I mean, she diagnosed her, so this is classic, this is horrible, traumatic disorder caused specifically by the abuse by the father. And that information should again have come in because it made her belief all the more reasonable. If she experienced those things, which again, the evidence shows she would have showed that she had experienced it, that then makes, when the child is saying, "Daddy hurt me," child's, you know, all the little things the child was saying, that made her belief in the child all the more objectively reasonable.
How does that make it objectively reasonable? She happened to have a condition that may have affected her perception of things. But you agree that the affirmative defense has to be tested by an objectively reasonable standard, correct?
Yes, but she had a condition that was caused by the abuse by the ex-husband. And the fact that, so she didn't have a condition, but she had, but the ex-husband had beaten her, raped her, tortured her, humiliated, degraded her, done all these horrible things, but didn't have a condition, it should have been relevant to explain why she then believes the child, when this child started saying, I'm afraid of daddy, daddy hurts me.
Well, it seems like what you're saying is that would explain why she would have an objectively unreasonable belief, not an objectively reasonable belief. In other words, she's like the eggshell, you know, plaintiff in a tort case. She has an unusual condition, causes her to perceive things unusually or more fearfully than the normal person would, or to expand upon threats. But that's not an objectively reasonable standard, is it?
Well, except, Your Honor, that the condition was caused by the ex-husband. If the condition had been caused by a terrorist act that she witnessed someplace else, blaming the ex-husband, being insensitive to the ex-husband would be objectively unreasonable. If, on the other hand, she's aware because she experienced that the ex-husband is so damaged that he would torture, he would beat, he would threaten, you know, he would hold a gun to her head, threaten to kill her, you know, that then believing that, you know, believing the child, when the child starts saying, daddy threatened to hurt me, you know, daddy hurt me, is actually objectively reasonable because of what she knew the ex-husband had done to her.
Right. Where do you draw the line? Go ahead.
Mr. Rosenfeld, I want to turn your attention to the issue concerning the former wife. What does the record show specifically as to when the first wife told your client about these other incidents?
In the year before she left.
No. Where in the record is it? How is it preserved? What was said?
I'm sorry, I don't have that in front of me right now. It was specific. It was an offer of proof.
Okay.
Right before the ex-wife was going to testify, and the judge said, "What's she going to testify?" And I told her, and she said, "You know, it's not allowed."
All right, but you're saying the record is clear that there's at least an offer of proof.
Yes.
That these conversations occurred in the year prior to what?
Prior to her deciding to leave.
Okay. All right, second
to leave what? Leave the state?
I'm sorry. Prior to her taking the criminal action of taking the action of violating the custody order and denying visitation.
Okay. Concerning this other issue that we've been talking about a little bit and the PTSD and her demeanor, if you will, while she's testifying, I didn't see any authority cited in your briefs for the proposition that you can put on a witness to testify as to why another witness might be testifying the way they are in a trial. Do you have any legal authority for that?
No, Your Honor. And if I may, I see, you know, where I am on time and I'm worried about it. The last thing that I wanted to go to is again where it's the objective reasonableness of her belief, something that occurs after she's caught. If even if it would make her belief more reasonable or less reasonable, should be inadmissible. And that's why there's the issue of the admissibility of the forensic interview of the child.
Why doesn't that go to her credibility? I understand your point. Why doesn't the child interview go to her credibility? It was put on in rebuttal, right? It was not put on in the direct case. It was only put on after she testified.
Right.
Only after she testified that she has suspicions of sexual abuse of the child, right? The child was called to, then they presented this interview. Why doesn't that go to her credibility?
Because if an interview later on, after she was caught, if it concluded that the child was sexually abused, or concluded that the child wasn't, they're equally irrelevant if she didn't know about it, if it didn't affect her state of mind.
But if the child is saying it didn't happen, that goes directly to your client's credibility.
Well, the child never said specifically it didn't happen, so I have no memory of it.
Well, if the child has no memory of it, it would logically follow, or a jury could infer, that the child never told mommy about it, contrary to what mommy said.
Actually, not. Actually, what we infer is, I've done a lot of these cases, if the child said it, the infrequently mommy must have been coaching her while she was in hiding. So if the child didn't say it after a year in hiding, it would infer mother hasn't talked about it, and there's been no discussion about why she was in hiding.
If the child doesn't remember something that mother testified, child told her about, that directly goes to mother's credibility. It's just logical. If the child doesn't remember something, the child, it could be inferred, didn't say it, because they don't remember it happening. Why isn't that a permissible inference?
Because child had been living with the father for almost a year and no contact with.
But that's an attack on the child's credibility, which you're free to do, okay? But it doesn't mean that what the child is saying is false. that she didn't remember anything like that ever happening.
Right, but it makes it just as irrelevant what the child said after she was caught. It just as irrelevant as the child says it didn't happen. If the child had said, "Dad sexually abused me," but the mother didn't know about it, it wasn't part of her belief at the time she went into hiding, it would have been equally inadmissible in either case because it didn't
different issues. Different issues. There's the issue of her state of mind at the time of the offense, and then there's the issue of her credibility testifying at trial. That's a different issue. It seems to me that the child interview goes directly to her credibility testifying at trial.
Respectfully, Your Honor,
your time's almost up. It is up, actually, but let me ask you one last question about the facts. You just alluded to the child being with the father. From the time of the apprehension in Missouri to the time the child gave this videotaped interview, was she back with the father, or was it taken immediately after the arrest in Missouri?
At that moment, when she was taken into custody.
In Missouri.
Before she's seen her father.
Right. So the father would have not have an opportunity to influence what she said in that interview.
At that moment, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Allen, and I'm here on behalf of the people. Just for the record and for the edification of the students, since they read the briefs, I'm not the attorney who wrote the answer brief in this case, but I agreed to take on the argument to allow the class to be able to watch.
Thank you for filling in, I appreciate it.
So I wanted to start with I'm going to start with the last issue first, just because I think that this court is absolutely right about what the forensic interview stood for here, for lack of a better word. It, with all due respect to defense counsel, he's completely missing the point of why the interview was admitted. It has nothing to do with what the defendant's state of mind was at the time she absconded with her daughter in, I believe it was August of 2008. The entire point of admission of that interview on rebuttal was because the defendant took the stand, so her credibility, like any other witness's credibility, can be questioned, and she specifically said, I want to make sure I have it here, that SW made statements and engaged in behaviors that led her to believe that the father was physically and sexually abusing her. That's on July 8th at several different points in the record. So the fact that during the forensic interview, SW said that no one had ever touched her on the place where she goes potty, and that she would tell her mother if someone had, directly goes to the credibility of the defendant saying that that's what she said to her. It has nothing to do with whether or not SW was or wasn't sexually abused. The sole purpose was a prior inconsistent statement under the statute. And in order to get that statement in order to allow the prosecution to attack the credibility of the defendant, they had to ask her about making the statement first.
So when counsel said she didn't remember, that was a direct testimony in court?
Yes.
She didn't remember giving the interview in 2008 or 9.
Her testimony was that she didn't remember either, if I remember correctly.
Well, yeah.
It wasn't just the interview. I thought she also stated that she did not remember she did not remember making a statement, so it would have had to have been that she never told her mom and she didn't remember making a statement in the interview. Sorry, I don't mean to be confused.
But in the interview itself, she denies having made a statement that father touched me inappropriately.
Yes. She said that no one has ever touched her on the place where she goes potty, and that she would tell this is during, and that she would tell her mom if someone did.
That's what you said in the taped interview.
That is what my notes say, that during the forensic interview.
Would you submit rebuts or addresses the credibility of the defendant, who in her case said she had reason to believe that father was sexually abusing her?
Well, it directly refutes her statement that the daughter said this to her, which then, yes, goes to her credibility. And the next thing I want to talk about is the question that had to do with the ex-wife and the three kids from the father's previous marriage. Because, actually, this is really interesting. This is from July 9th transcript. But at the beginning of the day, the trial court allowed the defendant and defense counsel to make the offer of proof about which this court asked. And I'm not going to just recite this into the record, but I think it's important that this is what was said.
Do you have a page number so we can look?
Of course, I printed it off, okay. The page number didn't come. But
okay, I'm sorry.
Starting on page 3, actually, so that's easy enough. And like I said, that's July 9th day. KY told her that he abused at least two of the three sons in her presence, of her son from her first marriage. One of them, when he got frustrated, he knocked him down. How old was the child? I believe he was 16 at that time. Another one was frustrating Mr. White. I believe he was learning disabled. How old is that child? Now? No, how old was he at the time? I don't know for sure. Then she says, you know, he was very young. I don't think she knows the exact date. She has no idea his age. It goes on and on. All she remembers, all her testimony would be, is that she remembers being told, basically, it goes on, for page after page, these vague, unclear, not only what actually happened to these kids, but how old they were when it happened, and when she was told this information. She never, I mean, with all due respect, if a parent learns frightening information about their ex, and they're in the midst of a custody dispute, you would pay particular attention to when you found that information out, because it would be relevant, presumably. And here we are trying to determine whether...
Relevant to what?
Well,
relevant to the domestic case or relevant to this case?
Well, relevant certainly to the domestic case, I would imagine, but here, specifically, when you know you're coming into court because you've been charged with a felony of, you know, absconding with your child, and you're going back through your memory to try to make these determinations of when you've learned this so that you can have this affirmative defense to show that your belief in danger to your child was reasonable, you can't just have these vague allegations. I mean, that's why we have these time frames set out in the cases that have been discussed.
Well, counsel, so what you're saying is the offer of proof is not clear as to when the defendant learned of the alleged prior abuse.
Absolutely.
Okay.
In fact, it is unclear.
Okay. So I want to go to the first issue, though.
Okay.
That's the issue of father's alleged prior abuse of the defendant. Okay. Seems to me the defendant's argument is that because the same person is involved in these alleged incidents, the father as to mother, father as to the child, that the fact that mother had experienced similar kinds of acts would be relevant to her state of mind when her child tells her that she has experienced similar kinds of acts, and would lead her to believe her child, and therefore would bear upon whether her belief was reasonable that it was necessary to take the child to protect the child. Why isn't that true?
Well, you know,
even if they occurred 3 years earlier, why isn't that true? He did it to me, so if she's saying that he did it to her, I'm going to believe her.
Okay, so she's saying that she did it to her, then why at the moment that the child says this to her mother isn't she running with the child because that's her reasonable belief.
But that's a credibility issue. That's something you might ask on cross-examination, okay? My question is, why isn't it relevant? Because this was excluded entirely on relevance grounds.
It isn't relevant because the issue is whether the person reasonably believed. It's not a person who has suffered post-traumatic stress allegedly at the hands of the person. It's a reasonable person who believes that harm is about to occur to their child. And in this case, it's evidence that has to do with evidence of danger to the child's welfare that's recent in time to the abduction. It doesn't have anything to do with a subjective state of mind. And I see where the court's going as far as, you know, if this actually did occur to the defendant, that it would make her believe when the child said something, possibly, that it was happening to her, the child, as well. But in that instance, I mean, you don't kind of backdoor your way into, you know, a mental health type of defense by trying to bring in all of this under the affirmative defense. I think that you have to...
But it doesn't sound like they're not making a mental health defense. They're saying, because it happened to me, because something similar happened to me, I believe my child when she says that the same person did it to her. It's a form of corroboration, it seems to me.
Well, I understand where the court's going, but I think, honestly, the gist of the argument with respect to the post-traumatic stress disorder had to do with the defendant allegedly freezing in court, which I might add, there's absolutely no record support for that. If that was occurring, someone needed to have been making a record about what was going on in front of the jury, and that did not occur.
Well, I think Judge Jones's question is, the wife having testified that she believed the child had been, say, hurt by the father, then wanted to bolster her own credibility on that issue by saying, not only did the child tell me she had been hurt by the father, but I had a reason to believe it because he had hurt me at some time previously. I think that's how Judge Jones understands the testimony. And I think the question is, why isn't the wife's testimony as to what the father did to her relevant to, in a sense, bolster her own credibility? And I think my question is, was there a time frame as to when the wife said the father had done these things to her? And it wasn't excluded because it had happened so long before.
Well, I believe that is why it was excluded, because the time frame, by virtue of the fact that she was saying it occurred during the marriage, was multiple years before this whole issue came about.
He could not have been beating the wife within months of her fleeing California, right?
That's exactly
because
right.
Because they weren't together.
That's exactly right. The divorce had occurred several years before, and I think that they even separated before that.
If the child's statements that daddy was hurting me did relate to incidents shortly before she fled, she might have connected those back to something that happened a couple years before. But she wasn't precluded from testifying to what she said the girl said to her, that daddy hurt me. She was allowed to say that.
As she was. But I would actually throw out there that I don't even think the record is clear from her testimony of when exactly in that period of time before she absconded with the child, when the child made this disclosure to her. We have no specificity with respect to dates. It is all general, vague accusations and nothing of significance, with the exception of the one date that we actually do have on the record is from the prosecutor, who said he had taken notes when someone else had testified, or when the ex-wife maybe had testified, that, or no, I'm sorry, I'm not remembering, but at one point he says, I wrote down that she learned about the baseball throwing incident on the other child in July of 2008. So that's the one thing that we can pinpoint that is relatively close to the August 7th leading.
But I want to get back to this issue because the cases deal with situations where, say, a parent allegedly hears about abuse of a child 3 years before the parent takes the child, okay? Years before, or months before the parent takes the child, okay?
Okay.
And the court says, no, we've got to draw a line somewhere. If these months pass, if these years pass, then we can't say that your belief at the time you took the child was reasonable. But this is a different kind of evidence. This is corroboration type evidence. This is not evidence of the child being hurt 3 years earlier. This is evidence that wife was hurt 3 years earlier, which led her to believe when these allegations occurred later by the child that the child was indeed telling the truth. It's a different thing, it seems to me.
Judge, I respectfully, I disagree. I mean, there's so many different things that go into it. You've got these years and years and years of, you know, this custody going back and forth. We don't know when during that period of time this child allegedly tells her.
That's a different issue.
But it isn't with respect to the reasonableness, even with this eggshell plaintiff type defendant who has allegedly, and I'll say allegedly strongly, you know, suffered this horrific abuse, which, by the way, was never reported. I mean, how far afield do you go when you're talking about whether she reasonably believed at the time she took the child? You have to look around that period of time. And you have to take into consideration, more important than her status, and I apologize, but more important than that, you have to have this time frame and you have to know when she had this belief, unreasonable or reasonable. And we don't have any of that because the record is completely unclear with respect to when she gains this knowledge.
Counsel, I think your time is up.
Yes, okay. Thank you. I apologize. I'd ask the court to confirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your time. Thank you for your arguments. The case is submitted and counsel are excused and an opinion will issue in due course.